This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
We have the pleasure today of welcoming Paul Haggerty, who's come all the way from Ireland to speak to us about Bataille, Agamben, and the Holocaust. Paul is a professor, or lecturer, as they're known, in French at UC Cork, and he's currently has a book out on Bataille from Sage. The book is actually, if you'd like to buy it, in the very back there where the wine is. You can take a peek at it afterwards. Currently, he's working on two very related projects, one of which is on Agamben, and the other of which is on the question of community. And perhaps we'll see some of those themes coming out today in the talk. So let me introduce to you Paul Haggerty.
Okay, thanks for coming along, and thanks for inviting and all that kind of business. I'm going to get on with it because I have loads of portentous things to say here today, so you'll have to bear with those. I'm not going to break from them. And I eventually developed a title as well, which is appropriately big, I suppose. Can you hear okay there? Good, yeah, right. I shouldn't be saying that again. And that title is In the More Than Silence of the Less Than Saying, and then Bataille, Agamben, and the Holocaust. And I suppose very briefly, so you know where I'm going for the bits which I didn't connect that well, there's going to be five sections here covering four different writers. They don't match up. If anyone's into Jeanette or Crémas or anything, you can construct a diagram for me, which I can take home, about how all these fit together. That would be lovely. And more particularly, perhaps, there are going to be three sort of themes that I'm going to pursue, three theoretical themes, through Bataille and Agamben and ending in Hegel. And those are failure, quietness, and the question of the exemplary, which I suppose is nearly particular. And I suppose what I'm really interested in is quietness here, due to the way in which the Holocaust is taken as a place for either a silence or a place where volume has to occur, where we should be loud for some reason or another. Now, I'm going to go through this again in a minute. But I mean something particular by quietness, and I'll just kind of state it for now. And it's partly to do with Bataille's own position on the Holocaust, which is potentially very empty. I'll mention that in a moment. So by quietness, then, I'll quote myself, I'm thinking of something like, where there is neither sound nor silence, where speech is, in the kind of Heidegger crossed out way, where a failure to speak is not absence of everything, but something which structures absence and presence of the said and the sayer. And this question of the sayer either disappearing into that place between absence and presence is what I'm going through Agamben for. I mentioned failure, and by failure I don't mean someone failing perhaps in the usual sense, but failure as a way of negotiating success and failure, if you see what I mean. You might do later. And by exemplary, it's really the example as question of its own exemplarity. I'll be going over that anyway. So that's five of something, four of something, three of something else. Two things I'm not going to talk about are Libeskind, who's perhaps a very overly known museum is here. You've listened to him a few weeks ago. I didn't have time to listen to him, so I'm sure he said very interesting things in his own special way. And the other thing I'm not talking about is Boltanski, Christian Boltanski, and the kind of reality of the real people and how we might somehow memorialize the realness of something horrific. Anyway, but they are specifically what is not being talked about here, rather than, you know, there are many things not being talked about. They're specifically what's not being talked about. All right, so I'll make a beginning somewhere. Gradually going to what I am including rather than what I'm not including. And another thing I won't be talking about, and beginning with this, is Adorno and Lyotard's, again, very well-known position on what we do when we assess, when we try to think the Holocaust as event. Now, with Adorno, we have the sense that the horror of the camps creates some kind of ineffability, Lyotard pursues this, emphasizing that it's the sense or sensing of the Holocaust and its impossibility that takes it into an unforeseen site of the sublime. We wouldn't expect to see the sublime there, we don't see it, and that not seeing it is what brings a particular kind of contemporary sublime. And the Holocaust moves into a position where it has always been that sublime. I don't mean that sublime as a qualifying thing there. Okay. Now, the Adorno and Lyotard position is one that perhaps acquires a popularity because it does match the common sense view that something impossible happened, something that we cannot grasp. What can we do with this? How can we get out of that other than by saying this is the thing we can't grasp? And so I'm really not going to say anything more about them other than to wonder whether the strange things that Bataille has to say and the perhaps less strange but very similar things that Agamben has to say might be more interesting. Okay, now the other thing that goes with this recognition of the impossibility of dealing with the Holocaust, of thinking the Holocaust in its own terms, rather than to assess it politically, which might be very straightforward, is the recognition that something unique is at stake. It's not necessarily a unique event, because that's a major debate, is are we talking about something unique when we talk about the Holocaust? Do we put inverted commas around the? Do we put them around Holocaust, as Agamben does on 99 out of 100 occasions in Remnants of Auschwitz, but not in the chapter on Bataille? I haven't actually counted them, right? But all of them except that one that I noticed, okay? There is a sense that the uniqueness is at stake, and that's what leads me into this wondering about the example. So I want to say something about that as a kind of aside here, and it's in very small print. This becoming example should concern us in what it says about the possibility of the exemplary in inverted commas, and concern as in care, possibly Heideggerian, possibly not. The debate about the Holocaust's uniqueness concentrates on whether there is something particular about the Holocaust, which is always in inverted commas when I'm saying it here, so I'm not going to do that anymore. If there is something particular, why is it? But also in becoming unique, the Holocaust begins to exemplify. It begins to exemplify very straightforward things, man's inhumanity to man, the danger of right-wing ideology, of mass politics, the West's attitudes to others, the centrality of anti-Semitism in European history. You know, the list could go on. And in exemplifying, something strange happens to the mass murder being looked at. There is a certain acceptance of the homogeneity of the final solution, which is to accept, to an extent, the purpose of the inverted commas solution, the obliteration of particularities of individuals or of entire groups. Also, it begins to mean, and this possibility of meaning as a danger we can see going on in Beckett in the Endgame, kind of backing up Adorno's suspicion that if anyone could had anything to say, it would be Beckett. It's Ham has a fear of coming to meaning in Endgame. Now, coming to mean means that it can acquire a use value. Something, it, begins to become something we can learn from. So somewhere between these two sides of ineffability and what we might call exemplarity for the moment, but it's not where I'm going to end with that, somewhere between that we get caught. Do we have this impossibility of thinking, or do we have a necessity of thinking through, of doing something with whatever it is we're looking at? And the redefining of the Holocaust as some form of the sublime does not resolve this, or, as excitable commentators might say, suspend itself between the two possibilities. Rather, it maintains them both. It wants the ineffability, but wants to make a political point of that. Now, maybe that's where we're going to end up today. However, if we also raise the example as question, then we can have more a sense of what this particular example, in inverted commas, might be, or what it cannot come to be. And Agamben has a very nice line about the example from the coming community, where he states that the proper place of the example is always beside itself in the empty space in which its undefinable and unforgettable life unfolds. And we'll be coming back to similar ideas, but the example is never the example, and it's not just in a sense of being the thing which is excluded from a language set or the thing which comes to define a language set. The example is of itself, only beside itself. And when we take a particular example, that becomes heightened. Perhaps this is that example which leads us into the questioning of the example suggested by Agamben elsewhere, but not pursued by him. In the example, the exemplar of the Holocaust, again, mentioning the name is challenged, the exemplar then is both beside the impossibility allocated to the event and is beside itself as example of all that it is and all that it's not, because it has to be the thing itself to be example, and it also has to become example and not be itself. In that sense, there is a link to the linguistic category of example. In becoming paradigm, its becoming paradigm is part of its specificity, because it is the paradigm that cannot be, of which use cannot be made, linguistically, ontologically, ethically, even though use is made, is demanded, and perhaps owed. There is a debt to placing it in this position of example, which is a failed negotiation of the ineffable on one side and the coming to mean, the coming to acquire use value on the other. All right, and I'll stay away from the portent for about 10 pages now. The next question, somewhere now that we're between those possibilities, is to do with how the Holocaust has been represented, how it has been thought, given, in terms of its witnessing, in terms of recognition, of memory, of coming to language through duty. This, of course, never more pressing than when the possibility of witnessing is reduced or threatened. Reduced either through natural death of survivors or threatened by self-styled revisionists. And part of this witnessing, in the overall sense, lies in the refusal to witness, which can take many forms. On occasion, as well as this refusal, we might attribute a particular meaning to the refusal, especially if we're dealing with very well-known philosophers who, you know, I'm not going to dwell on this particularly. I'm going to talk about Heidegger. But the examples are Heidegger, de Man, and certainly it's Melman's particular interest that Blanchot be included in the culpability of these characters as well. Very selective reading, perhaps. So following the cases of the first two, Heidegger, a very particular kind of refusal, de Man, maybe another category of refusal, but famous for the absence of saying something. Following the cases of the first two, writers such as Derrida seem perhaps too willing to collaborate with these problematic writers, their legacy too important to be reduced to their lives outside philosophy. I'm not going to dwell on that. In addition to that question, we have the puzzling position. There's a whole industry there to deal with that. In addition to this, we have the puzzling position of Bataille, who might perhaps also be readily placed along with these suspect characters as a forebear of contemporary theory, who actually has a very strange political position, shall we say. And Bataille's position is puzzling, hopefully I'll be able to show, in that he is almost as silent as Heidegger on the Holocaust, which is pretty difficult. Does this then imply an acquiescence, given his valorization of Nietzsche, war, sacrifice, death, and so on, which might suggest to the perhaps not immensely read that he would be in favor of Nazism. Unfortunately, I have to report that Agamben seems to share some of this conclusion, and Agamben takes a very circuitous route to imply that Bataille is at least unconsciously heading down that path, and he cites Benjamin as having seen one of Bataille's groups that he was involved with as, quoting Agamben, leading to fascism. This is actually a citing of Klossowski citing Benjamin, right, about one of Bataille's groups, and missing out the fact that Benjamin attended all the other groups that Bataille was interested in, such as the Collège de Sociologie, and left him all his stuff when he went to Spain. Minor things like this. Obviously, Benjamin wasn't dramatically worried, or was perhaps more politically advanced down the path of ambiguity. Maybe that's what was going on there. So that's an early dig at Agamben, but I should be liking him later. So what I want to look at here is the seeming failure of Bataille to address the Holocaust, and what this failure might mean, or more precisely, how this failure means, or whether it comes to mean at all. When read between Heidegger's silence and Agamben's apparently unknowing completion of Bataille's non-statement about the Holocaust. So I'm going to say something about Beryl Lang's book on Heidegger now, as a still something I'm not covering in the paper. So what if Bataille has failed in a way that succeeds, and that in some way he's writing quietly, other than saying nothing? All right, so I suppose this is it's still the first section. Heidegger then worries post-structuralism from many angles, as dogs can worry sheep, and raises the possibility, on the one hand, that the whole enterprise of challenging meaning, for example, might be fundamentally locked into dangerous politics, or perhaps worse, that there is a fundamental dishonesty going on here, a bad faith. It's interesting how many writers like the idea of bad faith but don't want to use the term, which is relevant, I suppose. But Heidegger's silence, according to Lang, is more complicated than a denial of his past or a strategy to avoid lending credence to those who would criticize his action or inaction. One of the arguments is that if he were to make any response, he's admitting a great level of culpability, even if he goes on to deny it. Okay, so Lang reads a significance into the silence as such, arguing that with Heidegger's silence on the Holocaust, quote, here silence is not something that can be replaced by words, that is a silence of omission, but a space in which silence is the answer. Which is very similar to Derrida's line, only Derrida takes that line to suggest that Heidegger signals a silence for us to think into, whereas Lang says, no, silence is the answer, full stop. And he says that over and over again. If you want to spend, probably $40 to read this, I'll probably save you that now. So Lang wants to argue that this silence means something much more concrete, that it has to be read amongst the words and events of the time not being referred to. Fine. Lang admits that silence may be, quote, multivalent, even if his text suggests no such thing. And he goes on to build a damning reading on the basis that Heidegger's few references to the Holocaust or to the, quote, Jewish question emphasize the essential silence, illustrating the purposive nature of his particular silence. Quote, by his very silence, Heidegger was addressing the Holocaust directly, forthrightly. Now, there are two direct references to the mass murder of Jews under the Nazis. The first compares this to developments in modern technology. The second cites the, quote, hundreds of thousands killed in the camps compared to the millions dying in China, which is now to us a very familiar strategy on the part of revisionist historians who say everyone suffered in the Second World War. It was a war, what do you expect? And that was the bit that I found most convincing in that particular book. The first line, intriguingly, doesn't actually feature in the English translation of the essay being quoted by Beryl Lang in any of the forms it appears, which is quite interesting. Someone has missed it out somewhere. I didn't have time to check the thing as to whether it was there, when it was there. The other element which is important is, and this is what's going to lead me into Bataille, is how the silence fits when taken alongside another major idea. So the silence is not just to do with the political position of the time, neither is it to do with a breaking down of the whole system of the particular writer. Instead, the silence comes to mean, when seen in the context of Heidegger, with what he has to say about the folk, the German folk, as exemplary people. Okay, what is important as a mediation, this is in the mid-30s, what is important as a mediation of any individual Dasein is how that operates at a wider level, and the most obvious wider level for that is the nation. the most obvious nation in terms of world civilization for Heidegger is the German one. This is quoting Lang this time. Other people do not count, not because they have been tried and found wanting, but because the criteria of folkhood that are then brought to a point in the German folk exclude other peoples even before they can be tried. So this has a particular bearing on the situation of German Jews, as it is they who are directly affected in the attempted realization of the mission of the German folk. They are the non-exemplary, that which challenges the exemplary and its functioning in terms of the homeland and so on. And, as was clear already in the 1930s, this would be put into violent effect. This isn't a theoretical non-exemplarity, or not merely one. Okay, so there is no way out for Heidegger, as his whole thought of the mediated being is not linked inevitably with racism, but is linked inevitably with this idea of folk and the German folk. So this is a kind of a second section. So unto Bataille's silence, is there some way in which this silence can be made parallel to Heidegger's, or is there a way of taking it away from paralleling that? In some ways, it's more striking. We know about Heidegger's past. We know what he was up to. Some people seem not to know for a long time, which might be puzzling. What is puzzling with Bataille is that Bataille is possibly the only thinker at the end of the Second World War who is capable of thinking the Holocaust. I'm not talking about intellectual prowess or whatever. He has a system of thinking which is ready, and yet he cannot take his thinking of the Holocaust, which is very sparse, into that system, which he is writing from the early 40s and comes out, for example, in 1947 in the form of The Accursed Share. Okay, so this system of thinking, and I'll go over how I see that operating in this respect in a moment, largely featuring expenditure, sacrifice, death, and taking the particular form of The Accursed Share. This system could have approached it, but doesn't. So the question is, can we think of this particular mass murder as sacrifice, something which is, those who put inverted commas around the term Holocaust are recognizing that we should not be calling this a sacrifice and attributing any sacred value to it. And certainly Bataille does not come to see the mass murder as sacrifice. My question is, perhaps he should. Why doesn't he go there? Why can he not go there? What does it mean? So what we have instead is a refusal to think the question. Instead of thinking the question, we have kind of several footnotes scattered through the sort of work of the 40s. I'm only going to mention a couple. There may be five or so altogether, which condemn this as something terrible. Modern society is really bad, and here's an example of how bad it can get. Now let's go back to the thinking. Let's go back to the theory. So perhaps there is something interesting in this particular failure, and the failure being the lack of incorporation into his thought. Why is it not brought into the thought? So particularity, purportedly, of the Holocaust is that on the one hand it is the sort of ultimate horror, but it is also the ultimate rationality. Without modernity's rationalism, Auschwitz cannot happen. And we can't forget either the very literal capitalist elements of modernity at work in the construction and development of the camps. There's, you know, you don't need to go to theory to find rationalism and modernity at work in the camps. For those after Auschwitz, inverted commas, it is the paradigm of what is wrong in modernity's project. And indeed for Agamben, modernity's project is essentially one that heads towards the camp. I won't quote him now. So what we might question is taking Auschwitz as exemplary of modernity. And I've mentioned before, there is the question of what can it mean to stand for the industrialization of murder whilst also being it. So Auschwitz called on to double, to not be itself, whilst at the same time standing as, in reality, total immanence. And a very nice word here would be rendering, but I've run out of sentence to put it in because I didn't like the rest of it. So I'll just mention rendering there. Bataille then can't bring this in as exemplary, but should. There are two ways in which he can. He can either bring it in to exemplify modernity, or he can bring it in to exemplify sacrifice. Neither are done. So, the reason I think Bataille is one of the main sources for approaching the Holocaust, even immediately after, in the aftermath of the war, is that he has spent all his time, maybe 20 years of writing at that stage, persistently attacking rationalist, utilitarian, capitalist, profane, limited, Western, modern, bourgeois society, and we can include petit bourgeois, whatever. But he has also continually advocated that society should be based on sacrifice and should at least not neglect violence as an essential component of its existence. So we have those two kind of ways that we're not approaching the example here. The pursuit of utility brings, and as a result of, something he calls a limited or restricted economy, the economy of fixed values where all becomes means, all become things. And in opposition to this restricted economy, this is now fully theorized in the late 40s, he offers a model of a general economy. So where the restricted economy has accumulation, preservation, progress, law, morals, the economic, the individual, the general economy has waste, sacrifice, expenditure, transgression, community, and death. And none of those are separate from any of the others there. So where the restricted economy seeks order and stability and is bad for Bataille, the general economy occurs as moments of collapse, destruction, rupture, and loss, and knows no limits. There is no reason for the general economy to ever end. Okay, which, if certain things hadn't been stopped, is exactly where they would never have ended. Now, there is a sort of dialectic, nasty word, between the two, between general economy and restricted economy. But what general economy aspires to is to being beyond of dialectics, one where there is never any synthesis. So most of the time, perhaps, we would be in the restricted economy. Our thinking is geared to knowing ourselves as subjects, as being able to have some kind of will to power in the world. We are in a world dominated by very literal economics. And then in between this, there would be a build-up. Due to the build-up of the accursed share, there are these kind of outbursts, which he calls festivals or sacrifice. And if we don't have these festivals or sacrifice, a far greater evil will occur. There is no way around this. His whole model is, I don't know how you put it, but there is a sense of fate about it. And Bataille has already attributed the wars of this century, that century, to this inevitable process whereby waste simply will come to be and will destroy much of what is. He writes, the excess energy, wealth, can be used for the growth of a system. If the system can no longer grow, or if the excess cannot be completely absorbed in its growth, it must necessarily be lost without profit. It must be spent, willingly or not, gloriously or catastrophically. Now, there are ways in which that has a bearing on things such as examples here. He seems to suggest, though, that some form of sacred brought about in earlier, more inverted commas, primitive societies by literal sacrifice can avert the potential catastrophes that await. Societies other than our restricted one knew how the general economy worked. To approach or to engage with the sacred would still be dangerous, but offers a paradoxical utility. One it does not aspire to, one that is beyond it, as the sacred is not. It's a utility which will never be attained, but will always be passed through and will be failing. It's a failing utility, I suppose. For this reason, then, the unattainability of the sacred, Bataille does not suggest a return to actual sacrifice. He's very clear about that. There are a painful number of references through his entire career. I don't mean us to really go and sacrifice real people. Disappointing, but he does say that many times. He does, however, insist that we stop denying the excessive dimension of existence and that through a consideration and presumably some enactment of general economy, things can be different. And this is where we start heading to the very strange position of how to bring in a very real and disastrous festival, in inverted commas. But here's his recommendation for what will happen if we bring in the idea of general economy. The extension of economic growth itself requires the overturning of economic principles, the overturning of the ethics that grounds them. Changing from the perspectives of restricted economy to those of general economy actually accomplishes a Copernican transformation, a reversal of thinking and of ethics. And reversals can go in many ways, presumably. And in terms of Nazism, perhaps, our problem is that we haven't respected this kind of need for some kind of general economy. We haven't had our outbursts of violence, our continual bursts of sacrifice. And so rationality has not been stopped. There's been nothing until this catastrophic sort of outpouring. Okay, so we could go down that angle and just leave him alone and say, clearly he doesn't like this. He spends the 1930s arguing against Hitler and fascism. He spends the 1930s arguing that Nietzsche has nothing to do with right-wing politics. But at the same time, and this is where the problems come in, arguably, what we have to do in France in the 1930s is tap into what Nazism is addressing. What is Nazism working on? How can we kind of get to some of that charismatic element? And Bataille has two terms here which precede the use of restricted and general economy. One of these is the homogeneous world. The homogeneous world is the world of work, Protestantism, taboo, morals, rationality, economy, and so on. And then on the other hand, we have the heterogeneous. Now, the heterogeneous is sacrifice, death, laughter, drunkenness, and so on, all of which he loves. It's also Hitler. Hitler is part of this heterogeneity that lurks beyond the homogeneous world. And we can't simply divide the sacred into right and left, as Durkheim and Mauss and co. would have done. We have to move on from that to mix them together. And that places you in potentially a very interesting, stroke difficult political position. Probably why Bataille never did anything politically, really. Okay, so the way out of this is that Nazism is very simple, in fact, perhaps too simple. Nazism has the same relation to the sacred as that of organized religion. It is the institution nearest to the sacred, but as institution, it specifically prevents the sacred from coming into being. For Bataille, Christian church is a negation of the sacred. Most religions, that would be the same for most religions, I would suspect, other than perhaps Buddhism. Okay, and Nazism stands in exactly that same position. It closes off the sacred in suggesting it. Right, so that's kind of where Bataille should have brought in this thing called the Holocaust just after the war, but it doesn't, so he doesn't. The Holocaust then could be seen as an extreme version of the pursuit of utility, if we take it down one path. Get rid of the Jewish people as efficiently as possible, as they are the essential underlined enemy of the Nazified folk, and the extermination of the other would be the ultimate rejection of the sacred as that which, being, becoming, being made to be other, is to be feared. In Bataille's system, as I've mentioned in slightly different words, sacrificial forms are held up as examples of the general economy, fearful, terrible, perhaps disastrous, but in some way faithful to human reality. But human will be gradually in inverted commas. There is no place for Bataille to refuse violence. And for example, and this is where we get into the detail of what he does have to say, Hiroshima, for example, is seen as sacrificial in an almost acceptable way. His system is happy, but it's not happy with Hiroshima. It says it can deal with it. I suppose what we can say there is Hiroshima is a very different kind of massacre, less predictable, instant, and you know, it's a shock, it's a burst of violence. But what Bataille's argument actually is that Hiroshima, as event, as example, actually serves to hide the fact that millions of people die every day. That's almost a quote. Okay, so he's happy with Hiroshima being part of this general economy. He also, perhaps alarmingly, but I haven't really gone into it in detail here, has an essay about Stalingrad, the end of the fighting in Stalingrad, where he writes that Hitler makes a sovereign sacrifice in keeping the German army fighting when there is no possibility of victory. And his idea of sovereignty is the height of subjectivity as failing subjectivity, as disastrous sacrifice. So it's almost as if he's praising this kind of sacrificing of his own people. Anyway, we can perhaps come back to that. I just want to mention two examples of how he does incorporate violence and sacrifice from real examples in the Second World War. So violence is and has been there as our untraceable origin and end. And as with Heidegger and a whole of phenomenology, we are I am, as I am not dead, as I am not you, I will never be my death, and yet my being is a function of that not being, and so on. The only difference with Heidegger and Bataille, arguably on this, I'm not a huge expert on Heidegger, is that violence is a constant in Bataille, that there should be violence, your existence is a violent thing. It's not a struggle, it is a violent thing. It's not Junger or any of that kind of business. Now, the mention of Heidegger then perhaps leads us too much back into the path to the Holocaust, but maybe not enough. His silence tells us much less, despite the huge amount of writing on the silence, than Bataille's quietness. I've given you most of the examples. There's one more example. There are two more examples, and then you've had everything out of 7,000 or 8,000 pages worth of writing, a lot of which is in the appropriate period. Now, Bataille's relative silence might display the void that cannot be stated even as he writes the void. You know, he's interested in nothingness, he's interested in death, impossibility, and so on. Perhaps this relative silence is a recognition of that, with the Holocaust being, inverted commas, that which specifically cannot be addressed, the site of highest failure, and therefore cannot be incorporated into a system. It is ultimate sovereignty, which, for those of you who've done a bit of Bataille, I should just mention this, is very close to inner experience, arguably another way of processing the Holocaust on an individual level. Inner experience is neither experience nor inner, is something that Jean-Luc Nancy correctly, he's correct every so often, something he correctly notes about Bataille's inner experience. Anyway, so sovereignty and sovereign failure could account for this relative silence, but perhaps not enough, so we'll come back to that later. The relative silence, then, of Bataille does contain specific mentions of what comes to be called the Holocaust, but it cannot find a place, a site, within Bataille's general economy, even if there would seem to be a way of placing it within. And this unplacing is perhaps why, today, it seems more of a position than that I'm characterizing as the Adorno-Lyotard position, which readily places the other where it can, admittedly, almost belong. And what I'd like to take us to is that this relative silence is not quietude, it's not a quietism that should be in any way suspect, but is a quietness which is odd for Bataille. Rather than stopping and finding it ineffable within Bataille, we can say there's something very specific. Bataille is a very loud writer. He's very tragic. He's very epic. He's very, sorry for the casual use of tragic and epic there, but he's very large and expansive in how he does things. So to be quiet is actually very peculiar. Okay, so this is what links it specifically to inner experience, which is a failure to experience your own subjectivity. So, in fact, I'm actually going to go down a footnote there just to say something briefly about that. This experience, which is the only true experience, would be the living of the impossible, living the silence that cannot be lived, and therefore is a living of failure, a living that fails to come to life, and this failure to come to life is retroactive. You arrive, do not arrive, or come to, indeed, a point at which you have come to not live, not come to life, and never had. This tearing, déchirement, is the definitive point of existence, but no matter how much you approach it, and you approach it through silence, through the very literal meditative technique of stilling your own inner voice or whatever you want to call it. No matter how much you approach it, there is no attainment, no mastery. Bataille's inner experience of sovereignty as failure, as the living through of a death not to come, of a voice not to come, of a silence that will not either arrive, clearly has the potential to address itself in failing to address, in failing as well, to the question of the camp. But we have to wait for Agamben for Bataille to tell us this. Bataille does not want to take us there. Now, perhaps importantly, Bataille refers to the Holocaust directly in an essay on de Sade. In Evil in Platonism and Sadism, again written in 1947, he argues that he is against the Holocaust for the same reason de Sade was against capital punishment. It is pure utility. For Bataille, Buchenwald and Auschwitz, words that he mentions, are the result of capitalism and reason. But how clear is this? And I'll just quickly do the quote in French and then my fairly poor translation. And that's not false modesty, it is a fairly poor translation. D'un bout à l'autre, le déchaînement des patients qui a sévi dans Buchenwald ou dans Auschwitz était un déchaînement qui était sous le gouvernement de la raison. The eruption of passions which raged, and sévir contre also has the connotation of punishment. The eruption of passions which raged in Buchenwald or in Auschwitz was entirely an eruption under the rule of reason. So it is a ropey translation, but just so you have the gist. What does he mean by passions here? Perhaps this does bring us back to the general economy. He, just prior to that citation, he quite clearly says, Holocaust is something very bad that should never have happened, and I'm against it in the same way Sade is against capital punishment. Then he has this strange linking of le déchaînement des passions, unleashing of some kind of passion, within reason, but not within reason. So perhaps this brings us back to the general economy, but with that linkage refused, unacknowledged. You know, in what sense can we talk of an eruption or an outburst? As for gouvernement, its appearance here has a multiple effect. Firstly, here anyway, the rule of reason does not have to be removed for passions, destruction and death to occur. Also, there might be a sense in which reason approves of its unchaining, that the unchaining is essential to reason itself. This then would legitimize not only reason as part of the general economy, but possibly also the general economy as just such a déchaînement sous le gouvernement de la raison, unleashing under the auspices of reason. Yeah, auspices is nicer. And thus re-legitimizing the camps as an inevitable outburst of something like a general economy. The link to reason, moving on slightly, with its attendant passions, or passion, would make the camps profoundly human, partaking of the attempt to control what is other, what is my death through the death of the other. But because the other never dies as other, but as other self, other not self, etc., it moves into the inhuman that comes to be the origin for the human, that which cannot be its own death. That is not to say murder is a key part of being human, let's have some more of it, but rather that the human, inverted commas, is based on violence and deferral of existence through deferral of violence. And in political and philosophical terms, the continual possibility of the iteration of what Agamben will call the sovereign exception. A quote, but I'll come back to this. Agamben, the zone of exception, the sovereign exception is the zone of exception between nature and right, and is the presupposition of the juridical reference, i.e. the existence of law, in the form of its suspension. Elsewhere, I'll be coming back to that. I'm just gratuitously leaving it now. Elsewhere, Bataille has the following to say. On the more or less human scale, nothing is more animal than Auschwitz, and he underlines animal in the same way that he's underlined human in something else I mentioned earlier. At one level, this is a simple, even simplistic, moral statement. But what is inhuman lies at both ends of the human, of the rational, just like the sacred. And the animal partakes of the immanent, that which is outside of the human splitting of subject-object. That's the human splitting of subject-object, even outside of the human subject splitting itself from object. The Holocaust, then, is feasibly a site for the immanence as described in Theory of Religion. It's the major feature of that book, which misses very late in Bataille's career, but appears very late, but was being written in the 40s. And this immanence applies to the animal, to that which is not the human, but above all to the human when not human, when annulled even as animal, i.e. when dead. Not just dead, but as corpse. Quote, in a sense, the corpse is the most complete affirmation of the spirit. Quite different from Heidegger's position, even if alarmingly close in another way. It is nothing, it is a thing which is not even an object. It cannot attain the status of object. It is perhaps abject. Now I'm going to gratuitously go down that path for a short while, to refer particularly to a reading he makes in probably a reasonably well-known essay, Reflections on the Executioner and the Victim, which I think has actually been translated. And this abject is not to do with the kind of abjection that Kristeva borrows from Bataille, but is just to do with abject as not object, not subject. I suppose it's quite similar. I'll just get on with it. The quote, the basic horror of things offers itself to the human being as a truth to be discovered. In other words, it is also necessary for man to go beyond what is normal, to know the far limit of the possible, la lointaine limite du possible, but he must pay the price, .. But the one who backs off and does not want to see is barely human. Now, this is in a review of memoirs of a Auschwitz survivor that he says this. Okay, so this is as near as he ever gets to bringing it into everything else he has to say about everything else. In his reading, executioners and victims all participate in an abjection that becomes primordial, opening the ultimate possibility of humanity. In other words, we all have something of this in us, and we should then refuse to place the Holocaust, the camps perhaps more accurately here, off limits as the inhuman, as this would be to misrecognize that the inhuman is in some way in us as much as it is outside us, and both of those at the same time. Hence perhaps why Bataille actually never refers to the Jews, the Jewish people, any of that. He mentions the deported. Now, the deported has a currency as a term to refer to those taken to the camps, but that is the only term he ever uses, which perhaps signals, what I'm suggesting is that signals a universalizing of some kind of experience, which is that failure of experience, something like the inner experience described in the book of the same name, that can occur paradigmatically in the camps, much as Bataille doesn't want to make that next step of linking it. The human, then, in inverted commas, is arrived at, not arrived at, never arrived at, through process, in this case of overt abjection. Quote, in a suffering, stinking, debased universe, each person had the leisure, italics, to get the measure of the abyss, the absence of limits of the abyss, and this is truth that both haunts and fascinates. End of quote. If proximity to the sacred involves occupying the depths of existence such that as human, as individual, you can no longer be where death is not even your own, such as it would have been, then in what sense can Bataille refuse the camps? He can neither accept, because of the horror, you cannot just go with that and say, that was a good thing, didn't we learn from that? He can't accept it because of the rationalization of death either, but nor can he reject it. Because it implies the loss of self, which is the only possibility for any selfhood, for sovereignty, and it implies the loss of the rational world. So he cannot go anywhere. This is the non-place where it all breaks down, because it does not all break down. There is no total separation of the world into sacrifice on the one side and rational world on the other, especially at this moment in Bataille. And let alone in what has become for anyone else the exemplary case of this impossibility. Auschwitz, then, inverted commas, is the excess of within or outside rationality, exemplary but not uniquely so. And this is where Bataille starts to lead us into Agamben. Because for Bataille, all sacrifice is exemplary. The exemplary then being that which is excluded from the everyday and always reconstructive of the origin. Itself only to be in its reconstruction, and all of that in moments of destruction only. Agamben has misunderstood Bataille's idea of sacrifice. I'll come round to this gradually. I'm just asserting rather than arguing. Has misunderstood Bataille's of sacrifice, placing it too specifically in the space commonly referred to as the sacred, the realm of sanctioned holy sacrifice. Sacrifice has its place for Bataille, not so much a literal place, but a central placing, a central place in the idea of all of society, a whole, in fact, which cannot take its place even as literal whole, being, quote, the nucleus of violent silence in and of human society. That's something he's writing in the 30s. This absence does come to not take its place, and this is written during the war. Nothing comes from sacrifice, and the communication of anguish that occurs in sacrifice is not the resolution, but the introduction and maintenance of tearing apart, déchirement, in the very center, in the heart of the human city, with city as potential representative of the human monument, which is something I droned on at people about when talking about Liebeskind on another occasion. But we who would be after Auschwitz, in the many ways in which you can be or not be after Auschwitz, what are we to do with this? Bataille's quiet, othered, post-Copernican ethic of this disaster does not answer the question or even raise the question of how we process this. We do not live in the situation. He does not live in the situation. He does not allow anyone else to live in the situation he seeks to describe as having relevance, if not meaning. Sacrifice or some violent horror elsewhere cannot be vicarious, but that is all we have. We are placed in the position of having to learn from, to take up some way of thinking about the situation, even though this attributes utility. To philosophize attributes, however negatively we posit those attributes. To remember might be to repeat, to iterate, and this is Baudrillard's argument about Shoah, which I'm not going to go into here, but it's that the interest in repeat, the interest in recording is actually repeating destruction. That's in Transparency of Evil, if I remember rightly. Recalling the always exemplary sacrifice Bataille sees at the, quote, heart of the human city, of the human monument even, the Holocaust must perhaps become non-exemplary. In approaching it, something of sacrifice, of meaning, of control, of understanding about that, is to be maintained as if this were at the heart of the disaster itself. As exemplary, the putting into play that is the work of the exemplar not being itself, the Holocaust is precisely what is not summoned in all of those statements that we have from Bataille, is not summoned, not brought, not carried, but brought, carried into the place that its exemplar is always for the first time established. Sacrifice founds all society in Bataille, and I'll go with that for the moment, but only ever after the founding has been and gone. For Bataille, it is not a question of the sacrifice bringing the law. It's not a totem and taboo, amusing anthropological situation. But of sacrifice in its becoming outside of law, always bringing law in its wake. Law as trace of the outside, now held outside. Sacrifice is the sacrifice of the sacred. Founding, then, is not the provision of a base, but the iteration of baselessness. And in this sense, despite Agamben's forceful rejection of Bataille's ideas of sovereignty and sacrifice in Homo Sacer, he argues against Bataille only to complete the latter's unthought of the Holocaust. Perhaps, bizarrely, bringing in the word Holocaust, the only time without inverted commas when he does that, something he also rejects. So a dual rejection, a dual failure, actually ends him, brings him to the interesting failure, which is into the site of Bataille's failure. I'll come back to that. Not in hundreds of hours' time, in a few minutes. I'm nearly there. And perhaps unwittingly to put the example of in the word in play. Quote, it's kind of a parallel rather than relevant quote. The Jew living under Nazism is the privileged negative referent of the new biopolitical sovereignty and is, as such, a flagrant case of a homo sacer in the sense of a life that may be killed but not sacrificed. All of this in failing to address both the idea of the Holocaust in this particular section and in Bataille. and where this takes us through the categorization of homo sacer against Bataille's idea of the sacred sovereign being, brings us into a process of failure, of aporia, and so on, familiar terms. So, more Agamben. In homo sacer, then, Agamben argues that there is an area between law and not law, human and not human, which realizes itself in the form of, inverted commas, the camp. The state of mere or bare life is what subsists as nothing at the moment of disjunction. This moment, in the theorizing of law by many people throughout the centuries, is present and never present in the paradoxical coming into being of law through force, wherein there can never be a final initial legitimation. In the notion of sovereignty, Agamben sees the performing, the iteration of this moment of exception where law is brought into being. The exception is the bringing into law as opposed to the idea of sovereign power which is interested in this capacity, and then the result of the bringing into law. So the sovereign is a moment of exception rather than exercise of sovereignty. And Agamben is interested in what lies between those positions, or is of interest to us in that he is interested in what lies between. This exception, the exemplary being of sovereignty as the coming into being of the sovereign, can also lead us out of law. The threshold is open in both directions. The law, an infinitely thin line, perhaps always to be crossed, being in the crossing. And this line, unlike Foucault's in Preface to Transgression, has always only already been line as it becomes space. It can't even exist as a line to be passed out to not have been. It is a line not becoming space that we see in Agamben, I would assert. And this becoming space is in the spacing of law, humanity, and language from not law, inhumanity, pre-language, pre-linguistic being, whatever. The camp, then, is the staging not of the limit, in whatever sense we can have limit in the singular, but the reliving of the exception. What is different, however, is that the exception loses its exceptional status. The camp is the place, the exemplary site of the exception becoming non-exemplary. Quote, the state of exception ceases to be referred to as an external and provisional state of factual danger and comes to be confused with juridical rule itself. And that's from Homo Sacer. So the camp cannot be seen as a moment of exceptional horror, either in its own right or as a moment in modernity. What is novel is the perpetuation of the exception. What is at stake is not the moment of the inhuman, but the rendering inhuman combined with the maintenance of the human. In Remnants of Auschwitz, he writes that, quote, Auschwitz is precisely the place in which the state of exception coincides perfectly with the rule and the extreme situation becomes the very paradigm of daily life. But it is this paradoxical tendency of the limit situation to turn over into its opposite that makes it interesting, and for me makes it refer back to things Bataille has not quite said. This rendering inhuman summons, quote, bare life being that which is beyond or before the human-inhuman line comes to be drawn, to have been drawn. The bare life, quote again, the bare life to which human beings were reduced neither demands nor conforms to anything. It itself is the only norm. It is absolutely immanent. As with Bataille's animal existence, as with the corpse's immanent sight of the line between human and not human. And this bare life, to be realized, to have been realized, or not, in the figure of the Musulman, the one already dead. Quote, the Musulman is not only or not so much a limit between life and death, rather he marks a threshold between the human and the inhuman. For Agamben, there is nothing mystical here. There is no grand philosophical principle. There is the exercise of political power bringing this moment of sovereign exception. And then and only then, and then not then, there is a sense of the mystical moment where law is impossible, as in Montaigne, as in Pascal, as, you know, covered by Derrida and so on, Cornell. Equally, there is no sacrifice here, no Holocaust. But if we remove the notion that sacrifice implies either will or gain and institutionalized religion, then the Bataille notion of sacrifice returns. And as Agamben himself notes, the camp as the site of destruction is one form of the biopolitics in the Foucauldian sense that defines the city. Biopolitics arises through defining the city as a place to be divided. Where's that? That's in first volume of History of Sexuality, as well as numerous essays of the late 70s. Arguably, its paradigmatic form, even the campus paradigmatic form of that biopolitics. Bataille does not make this link, and this is not just because of some ethical scruple, I shouldn't mention it, nor is it because sacrifice cannot both be advocated as the essence of community in a good way and in practice be mass extermination. The troubled link to the rational and, expanding on Agamben, the problem of the establishing of the rational that comes as a result of the camp's sovereign exception made unsovereign, made non-exceptional, made exemplary as exceptional. The establishing of that comes with the logos, the law, the human, and this is what prevents Bataille's mastery of the Holocaust, a mastery he seeks to not have, a failure he seeks to have. But this failure stands as more than silence, stands as a meaning failure when read in or through some of Agamben's ideas, I'm gradually arguing. In brief, Bataille realizes, inverted commas, the Holocaust cannot be sacrificed in his terms, whilst Agamben fails to realize that he describes exactly what Bataille would have argued had Bataille not failed to read himself. Therefore, for the functioning of this non-failure, the figure of this functioning non-failure is to be found in the notion of the witness. And witnessing is going to take us into Hegel, and then we're nearly there. Via Primo Levi, Agamben notes that, quote, those who did not bear witness and could not bear witness are the true witnesses. From this, it follows that, quote, perhaps every word, every writing is born in this sense as testimony. This is why what is borne witness to cannot already be language or writing. It can only be something to which no one has borne witness. And this is the sound that arises from the lacuna. Witnessing is outside language is the testimony, that's the end of the quote. Witnessing is outside language is the testimony of being forced outside language. It is not silence, but it is barely there, a remnant rather than an absence. And this barely there is the bare life left after the becoming inhuman, of the becoming human out of the inhuman. Quote, the human being is the inhuman. The one whose humanity is completely destroyed is the one who is truly human. The identity between human and inhuman is never perfect, however, and it is not possible to destroy the human. Something always remains, italics. Still italics, the witness is this remnant. End of quote. The witnessing is what lies between human and inhuman as the Muslimmena themselves lived, inverted commas, without discourse, but in the possibility of testifying through the imposition of the impossibility of either language or non-language. Quote, the human being exists in the human being's non-place, in the missing articulation between the living being and logos. Agamben goes on, the subject is thus the possibility that language does not exist, does not take place. And, end of quote, now me, this not taking place is the site where it cannot be, cannot come to language, and this not coming to being is the sovereignty of the witness in Bataille's failure, and is senseless without Bataille's failure and Agamben's failure to read Bataille's idea of sacrifice. Somewhere in silence that is not one, as in the notion of inexperience, inner experience, where the becoming silent approaches sovereignty, bringing with it its failure, its felicitous failure, its quietness, not its silence, is where we not quite are. Last part. Emerging in silence, as silence that is not silence, returns us to the sublime, perhaps unfortunately, not that of Lyotard, but this time of Hegel. Sorry, did I say Lyotard? I meant Kant. I wrote Lyotard. Here the voice speaks, bringing existence into being so that it can be heard, so as to speak. It is not that a witness is required for the voice to be heard. It is that there is to be witness. But in this coming to be of existence as witness, there is no sound except as missing. The original sound cannot be, but is, and is therefore infinitely quiet, not absent. And anyone who wants to look at the quotes can in a moment. I'm not going to read it out because I haven't practiced reading the German and the English needs loads of footnotes. And I'd like to have this on record. Thanks to Katrina Leahy of Trinity College Dublin for the difficult bits of the translation. Back to Hegel. In the quietness that has come from failure of completion, this is in Bataille and Agamben, towards Hegel, in the quietness that comes from failure of completion, rejection of the use value of the Holocaust, of the assessment of exemplariness falling away in favor of the exemplary, which itself falls away as the exemplary becomes exception, and then as exception becomes exemplary, failure of exceptionality, as it can only when it is the drawing of the line between life on the one hand and bare life stroke death on the other. In this quietness, there is nothing to be gained, but it is the nothing that defines that which it is not, a return to something rather than nothing, perhaps inverted commas, and a return to a sublime which is nearly something rather than nearly nothing. The figure of the impossibility of voice, the impossibility of silence, and the impossibility of the between, quietness, which structures the other impossibilities as possibility. When God, in Hegel, creates the universe, it is a creation that is a witnessing, a bearing witness to, Zeugen. But there can be no witnessing before or at this time. The witness and the thing to be witnessed cannot have come into being, and never can, but always have already come. God speaking, Ausserung, and uttering, Hervorbringung, bring from the inside to an outside which only comes into being in the bringing. What is brought? Almost nothing. An uttering which is, quote, immaterial, ethereal, in whose command to exist now, this is Hegel still, in whose command to exist now, also that which exists is really placed in unmediated silent obedience, a silence of witnessing, a silence of creation, the silence of God bringing into being that which is to be witnessed, to bring witnesses to that which cannot be witnessed. There is nothing but the nothing between word and silence, perhaps quiet, and this nothing then is all, at which point the word has been, and all is brought to have become before the word, and all is brought to have been, and to have been becoming before the word, such that the word be spoken. The word is not here, any here. In this not here is the witnessing, the place of the writing, the unwriting that enters the imminence and can somehow not get to what bare life is in the camp. There you go. Will I read you the English Hegel quote so you know what the hell I was going on about there? With a proviso that there's more to this than meets the ear. God is the creator of the universe. God is the creator of the universe. This is the purest expression of sublimity itself. For here, for the first time, the idea of material creation, and that's Zeugen, and of the simple emergence of things from God disappears and makes way for the idea of creating, which I think is Schaffen here, as spiritual power and activity. God spoke, let there be light, and it became light. Has already been introduced by Longinus as a striking example of sublimity. Example. I could have made more of it. I didn't. Wasn't I good? God, the one substance, goes forth to speak, but the nature of the uttering is the purest, itself immaterial, ethereal expression. The words, the expressing of the idea as ideal power, in whose command to exist now, also that which exists is really placed in unmediated silent obedience. And that lives in volume 13 of the Complete Works. Do we have questions now?
No. Where is the Thai review of the Holocaust memoirs?
It's I don't have the reference to the translation. I can tell you where the French one is, if that's all right. It's volume 11 or 12. I can tell you that, playing for time. Volume 11, 262 to 267. Yeah, more questions like that? That's a good one.
I'll ask a question like that. What keeps your whole argument from simply transposing the paradox that you presented initially between inevitability on the one hand and political usage, basically, on the other? And as a paradox, it seems to me that you articulate essentially the conclusions that you arrive at when you articulate the paradox that is your starting point.
The difference is that, and why Agamben is interesting, is that he goes through that paradox and tells us something. So the paradox occurs somewhere other than where it occurs with Adorno and Lyotard, which is a kind of ineffable. With Agamben, we get plenty of detail. We get a running through the functioning of the camps. The paradox takes place elsewhere in the same way as Foucault isn't the best at raising paradoxes, but he, it's very similar to that.
I guess then the other question, sort of be a corollary to that, is what do you make of the bare life model in terms of its generalizability for real? Like, I understand the paradoxical nature of bare life as a quote, in reality that is exposed by the Holocaust, but how far do you think Agamben is carrying that ball in terms of the historical progress model, and how do you think it relates with the more typical singularity ideas that are usually used with respect to the Holocaust?
I was surprised. I didn't really have time to think about it. It did strike me that it was very simplistic when applied elsewhere. So he talks about people in kind of vegetative condition as being in bare life. So when you're going, now what are we talking about? And in a way, if we were to take the whole of what he does with bare life, it would heavily undermine its use anywhere, is my first response, because I was puzzled as to what to do with the other bits. That there's a better case to be made for leaving it only in a limit situation of, which is kind of where I was trying to head by making it much more like the line between human and inhuman when taken as being something that may or may not be sacrifice, where there is the potential of willed destruction of one sort or another, rather than, oh, you seem to be in bare life, walking through a hospital and deciding who is in bare life and who isn't, and how that heads down to eugenics, ultimately, with the life not worth living, which is one of the Nazi things of the late 30s.
How are you making the distinction between sort of this is a liminal situation, the professor, and this is a liminal situation, the improvisor? Let me give you just sort of two examples that I think you're dismissing. One is you've got somebody on the death row, and you give them the opportunity, look, you're basically already dead. Can we operate on your body in some unorthodox ways? And if you manage not to die, we'll let you go. And the other would be Locke in the Second Treatise, after arguing fervently that there should be no such thing as slavery, allowing for the possibility of slavery when somebody has tried to take your life, you've got in this in your power, and you are making your slave and can always get out of it. That is, he's not really a slave, because you can bring death upon him. Yeah. It seems to me that those do match up structurally with what Agamben's talking about, and to sort of say, well, this non-exemplary case of the Holocaust is is non-exemplary because it's the true liminal situation, is dismissing the whole sort of structural account of what Agamben's giving us.
I think that if we're raising an exemplary as question, then we bring in layers of example where one feeds back to another example. So, if, for example, we go for the moment with the idea that this applies to the Holocaust as example of this and perhaps sole example of where we can talk about bare life, and then I added in this caveat of willed destruction in one form or another, then I think we can transfer that back very without a problem to death penalty and say that is to do with like someone on death row, and then what happens to that person, the possibilities offered to that person, can be seen as a result or corollary of that exceptional status of a rationalized society placing someone in where for the good of society, someone, like there are sacrifices of people to be made for the good of society. I take the point about the Locke and slavery thing as well, which is very similar to Montesquieu and Rousseau's justification of the death penalty, which is, no, there should be no death penalty. Well, I'm thinking especially of Rousseau in social contract, well, where it's no death penalty, but if you put yourself outside of society, we have to take you further outside and kill you. Okay. And I think those are absolutely relevant questions for that idea of bare life, which is a limit situation between rationality, something which purports to be a sacrifice, useful or non-utilitarian, and how that is then processed into other processes of use value, for example, experiments, or that person who was sliced a million different slices, which that would be a really interesting case. But I did find it quite thin, a bare argument. to apply it to people who we couldn't assess how much they were inside humanity in all of the categories we might use for that, like is the whether brain dead or not, is the heart moving, do you need a respirator, all these kind of things. I think it is transferable. I don't think it just works in the one case, but all the places it could be transferred to, this would be my suspicion rather than something I've thought about a lot, is that it is transferable only in the basis of initially being exemplary in one case.
Right. So then if I'm understanding you correctly, when I put this answer together with your answer to the last question, a Gauman is going wrong because a Gauman's thinking he's got a sort of a blueprint for this situation, this liminal state, and he's going around applying it rather than going through, actually consistently going through the paradox of the Holocaust as the non-exemplary exemplar and thinking about that and sort of seeing things through that prism. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, although I wouldn't be as strongly critical as that. The way I'd be strongly critical is he should have spent as much time on those cases, like the case of someone in vegetative state, as he spends on the Holocaust. Give me 150 pages telling me why that is, and then I think differently about it. I think he, whatever the opposite, whatever dismissive is when you're actually in favor of something, that's how he is with that. It's too easy or something, perhaps. Yeah.
My question has to do with just the way your essay ends, and this is it's going to sound critical, but it's actually, I just want you to talk about maybe the irony of sort of moving from or dismissing the Kantian sublime in favor of the sort of Hegelian sublime, when the Kantian sublime is really a Jewish sublime. It's a sublime that is staked on a kind of claim about the way that Jews think about...
Can I throw a pen or something?
God. And, I mean, I'm certainly not the first to say that, you know, that Hegel is... Hegel's sublime is a Christian sublime, and that Hegel is, a fairly Christian thinker, and that Hegel this is a strong argument, and it wouldn't be my argument, but there are people who, especially Jewish scholars, who would say, you know, it's funny because in Hegel's system there is no place for the Jews. In a strange way, they're completely aberrant within his sense of world history. So I'm just wondering, what you make of that.
Okay.
I don't have an answer,
I mean, I wouldn't. I have a lot of time for Kant's sublime, especially the bit about aliens living on other planets and stuff. That's a favorite moment. But we can work back from the difference between like Agamben or arguably the position today and on one hand Adorno and Lyotard on the other, and find exactly the same difference between Kant and Hegel, which is that Hegel's sublime is historicized, however we want to regard that. And his does all of the things that Kant does, but in a historicized context, which admittedly is the Christianized historical, a kind of teleological kind of context, so we can overstate that. I mean, it's probably a problem when you read something too often and you keep going back over it, but it seems to me that in there, that's one of the clearest indications of a kind of retroactive, kind of deconstructive origin there of God, like the God in Hegel. Now, many people have argued this over the last 200 years, that the God in Hegel is God, and therefore is only historically about a Christian society building a Christian God, and almost accidentally and arbitrarily talking about that God rather than the reality of that Christian God, which, again, I think is very similar to Rousseau. So I don't think it matters that much to the reader coming after those various opposed positions. I'd also add into there, like for rhetorical purposes, I didn't mention it in the beginning, but Lyotard's sublime actually is more like Hegel's than Kant's anyway, in some ways. It's missing crucial bits of Kant. Let's put it that way. It's not a brilliant answer.
It was a brilliant question.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah, any more? Okay. Yeah, sure.
Because I've also been struck by Bataille's attempt to outdo Hegel through a Hegelianism in a certain way. And also reading, I haven't actually read from Mustafa, but at least the Manuel content and other, I think it's probably through a Benjamin influence as well, but that in the sense that I feel that Agamben is committed to the dialectic as well. And I'm curious that at the end of the paper, you almost lodge the aporia that you were working out in the paper back into ultimately an aporia of the dialectic, of the point of the aporia ultimately between appearance and word. And at that point, between image and word and the incommensurability and the sense between the two. And I'm just wondering so in other words, where do we go with your paper now? Are we going to say that the working through the dialectic, basically Agamben's taken us to the absolute limit of the dialectic, the point of absolute kind of, what's the right word? The place that's no place. I mean, that's not even exemplar, but it's outside the example. Yeah. It can appear. It's the absolute in between in a certain way. So it's that point of the dialectic where it's neither movement or not movement. You know, you've completely so now is the task to try to think outside the dialectic altogether, or is it to still remain within this?
Well, the response of many is, well, that's where we end up. You know, if you think about there's always the kind of Derrida position, which is you can't go out, so there's nowhere to go. Right? You think you've gone somewhere, and all you've done is confirmed the working of the dialectic. It's very, you know, if we try and state what do you have other than the dialectic, but specifically other than the dialectic, you are still somewhere in the orbit of that dialectic. So I suppose where I'd say that you would go in terms of theoretical models is to think the difference between a fullness and emptiness, which is that there is a lot of... Loads of writers love the kind of empty place. And, you know, I went on about it myself today. But there are kind of different deconstructions, some of which are full and some of which are empty. So the difference between Derrida and Blanchot is that Blanchot's is there's nothing between the things. Derrida always has something between things. Bataille, in his kind of non-dialectic, has immanence, has absolute fullness. It's kind of noise, actually, rather than emptiness. Whereas Agamben does have that kind of non-place. So I would say you would continue, and both of those stop a dialectic happening, either emptiness by itself or noise. And if you go between that, then you're moving, instead of a dialectic where you have sense on both sides and then something in between, however we want to think about that, you can actually place nonsense on both sides, noise on the one hand, absolute fullness, immanence, and arguably that might include death and all that business, and total emptiness on the other, with the dialectic in the middle as a kind of thing that keeps us busy to kind of not pay attention to the others. So then you start structuring according to two models at the same time rather than linking them together. That's off the top of my head. But that's what I would spend my time doing, is precisely trying to think that question without getting there, but trying to cover something. That's why I like Agamben, because he's there and somehow dealing with actual political situations. And even though I was critical of what he has to say about some of his use of bare life, that's a question which it would be nicer if more writers addressed rather than like just sort of staying abstract. Yeah. Again. Yeah. Okay?
Should we call it a day?
Cool. Okay.